A man is dead after a gunfight with police on the Blackfeet Reservation. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Ketchum Fry tells us about the economic impact of our two national parks. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce looks at how a group of moderate Republican candidates hope to fight dark money attacks. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talked with Bozeman Olympian Heather McPhee about her Sochi experience. FBI officials say a man has died after being struck in an exchange of gunfire with tribal police officers on the Blackfeet Indian Reservation. FBI spokesman William Facer said in a statement today that Blackfeet police officers responded to reports of a man with a gun yesterday evening. Facer says the officers found the armed man and shots were exchanged. The man was hit and died upon arrival at the hospital. The statement did not identify the man, nor did it say how many officers were involved, whether any of them were injured, or who fired first. Facer said he could not release any additional information. The FBI, the Glacier County Sheriff's Office, and the Montana Highway Patrol are investigating the shooting.
Police in Missoula are investigating the death of a man whose body was found along the railroad tracks. Sergeant Travis Welsh says a Montana Rail Link employee found the man's body at about noon today. Welsh says the man had been dead for more than 24 hours and that his body had been covered in snow. Welsh tells the Missoulian the man may have been a transient, was known to police, and had been in Missoula for about a year. Welsh says the man's cause of death hasn't been determined, and it's too early to determine if foul play was involved. His name was not released.
And in other news from around the state, a SkyWest Airlines airplane slid off the main runway at Missoula International Airport about 8 o'clock this morning. SkyWest spokesman Wes Horrocks says the plane was headed to Salt Lake City.
SkyWest Flight 4600, operating as Delta Connection, was planning to head to Salt Lake from Missoula as it was taxiing out to the runway, the nose gear slid off or left the side of the runway as it was traveling out to the runway to get ready to take off. There were 44 passengers on board and 3 crew members.
No one was injured and there was no damage to the plane, and it eventually took off. The airport was shut down for a couple of hours, but Airport Director Chris Jensen says only one flight was delayed. Jensen says airport workers treat icy runways with sand and de-icer.
You know, we had both freezing fog and we'd had freezing rain overnight, and so those things combined probably were making conditions slick, just as, you know, the same as what people were seeing on the city streets.
Jensen says workers will use this incident to review their procedures and response.
Unstable weather conditions hampered travel around Montana today, and forecasters warn it may worsen as warmer temperatures and rain melt the record snow dumped on parts of the state and threaten flooding, ice jams, and more avalanches. Interstate 90 was closed between St. Regis and the Idaho line because of the avalanche threat in the mountains above, and Montana Department of Transportation officials plan to force slides along the most dangerous areas by detonating charges. As of 4 o'clock this evening, the section was reopened for public use. The avalanche danger remains high in parts of the Missoula foothills, where an avalanche Friday buried 3 people. A 68-year-old woman died Sunday of injuries sustained in that slide. West Central Montana Avalanche Center Director Steve Karkinen says the rain falling in Missoula will further weaken the snowpack. National Weather Service meteorologist Dave Bernhardt says more than 40 inches of snow fell in Missoula in February, the most for that month since record-keeping began in 1892. He says Billings also set a February record with 37 inches, while Helena received 26.5 inches, which is 5 times the average. High temperatures forecast to be in the 30s and 40s this week means that all that snow will begin to melt. Bernhardt says that could lead to areas of flooding in Helena and west of the Continental Divide because of poor drainage, plus the risk of ice jams causing southern Montana and northern Wyoming waterways to flood.
The U.S. House has passed legislation to prevent mining and oil and gas drilling on federal lands along the North Fork of the Flathead River. The North Fork Watershed Protection Act, sponsored by Republican Representative Steve Daines, is a version of a legislation introduced in 2010 and in 2013 by U.S. Senators Max Baucus and John Tester. The bill would withdraw federal lands from mineral and geothermal leasing along the area west of the Glacier National Park. Daines says Baucus began work to protect the watershed in 1974 and that the bill's passage today will send a strong message to the Senate to approve it. Oil and gas companies have voluntarily retired about 80% of the total leased acreage in the area. Baucus previously said passing the legislation was a priority before he left the Senate.
A 1965 graduate of the University of Montana Forestry School is giving the school $1.5 million to endow a professorship in conservation biology and policy. The gift from Wyoming resident Earl Laser and his late wife Patty was announced today. The couple worked as naturalists and journalists, traveling the world writing about conservation and natural heritage issues.
We were exceptionally fortunate to visit and write about some of Earth's beautiful, wild, and biologically unique places. But in the process, we also witnessed firsthand humankind's sobering worldwide assault on natural places and wildlife.
And Laser believes that assault raises important questions and challenges.
And Patty and I were never bleeding heart preservationists. We believed, however, a paramount question facing us in the 21st century is how might ever-expanding human populations live close to or amid the world's last remaining wild or natural places without, in fact, destroying those places and their biological assets.
Laser says UM School of Forestry can make a real difference and play a leadership role in meeting the conservation and quality of life issues of the future.
The question is, what do we want our life's landscape to be and look like in the future? Not just a conservation question. It's a question of quality of life and heritage issue for future generations.
The new position will be called the Earl and Patty Laser Endowed Distinguished Professorship in Conservation Biology and Policy.
Out-of-town travelers make up the vast majority of visitors to national parks, and they dump a whole lot of money into local economies. Nationwide, that number is $13.9 billion for 2012. These are findings released by the National Park Service in a report that details the economic impact of national parks. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry breaks down how that plays out in Montana.
Every year, the National Park Service releases a report detailing the economic impact national parks have on the economy. Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell, hosted a conference call with reporters on Monday. She says the report helps her make the case for funding parks.
And by having it on a state-by-state basis and even a park-by-park basis, that can be used within local communities to make the case for why their local elected officials should support the national parks and, frankly, other public lands as well because of the economic drivers they provide to those local communities.
Jewell says during the government shutdown last fall, parks counted nearly 8 million fewer visitors than the previous October and a loss of $414 million of visitor spending in the gateway communities surrounding the nation's parks. National Park Service Director Jonathan Jarvis says gateway communities are defined as those within 60 miles of a national park. That encompasses the Flathead Valley and then some.
This is where folks buy their gas and stay in hotels and buy supplies and the like. Very, very strong impact in these local communities. A very important part of the economic impact of the national parks is that it is at the gateway community level.
Of about 2 million visitors to Glacier National Park in 2012, almost all of them were from out of town, and they dropped $172 million into the local economy. Yellowstone saw more than 3 million visitors who spent more than $400 million. Jarvis says for 2012, they used a new model, working with the U.S. Geological Survey to create the report. He says the changes make for some more specific and accurate information at the local level, but make it hard to compare numbers from 2011 to 2012.
It looks like visitation went up, but its overarching impact to the country went down slightly. But that's because of these economic driver factors. But the bottom line of sort of a dollar invested in the national parks still results in a $10 return to the American economy.
Jarvis says they incorporate surveys from many of the local gateway communities, gauging how many days the visitors stay, how much they spend, and where they spend their money. In Montana, a report from the Institute for Tourism and Recreation Research out of the University of Montana shows national park visitation for the state down 64% for the month of October during the government shutdown. The report states that nearly 90% of those coming to visit Montana in 2012 came for the state's landscapes and recreation opportunities, including Yellowstone and Glacier National Parks. It calls Montana's tourism industry as a whole a $3 billion industry. Katrin Fright reporting from the Flathead.
A group of moderate Republicans who denounce anonymous campaign spending in elections say their Political Action Committee, or PAC, plays by the rules. PACs have been the source of so-called dark money over the last few election cycles. A lot of that spending in Montana has been aimed at helping more conservative Republicans win primary campaigns. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us the moderates say this time they're fighting back and in a transparent way.
We think that the extremists and their dark money groups have taken this party someplace it doesn't belong.
Kalispell Republican Senator Bruce Tutvet is one of the leaders of the moderate GOP lawmakers calling themselves responsible Republicans. That group broke away from conservative leadership to vote with Democrats on some of the biggest issues of the last legislative session. Conservatives like Senate Majority Leader Bozeman Republican Art Wittig describe it as a betrayal.
You look at these crossover Republicans joining with Democrats to grow government.
The divide between the two sides appears to be growing wider ahead of this June's primary election. The anonymous group American Tradition Partnership, or ATP, made headlines the last couple election cycles for blasting moderates in Republican primaries with negative campaign mailers and other ads. ATP seems to have dissolved since then, after accusations it was illegally coordinating with candidates. Moderate Senator Tutvet says it doesn't matter ATP is gone. A lot of the same forces will still be at play.
They can sprout these things up on a heartbeat. All they got to do is find some dark money donor, and away they go. And
frankly, I think you're going to see the fact that a lot of these people criticizing dark money are hypocrites.
Again, Senator Wittig, one of the conservatives.
They're out there raising money. They're going to spend money. They've been out recruiting candidates against conservative legislators.
The moderates do not shy away from the fact they are raising money for primary election advertising. In fact, they're proud of it, calling their PAC a light money PAC. Senator Tutvet.
We want to be able to stand up and say, no, you can run a campaign properly. You can be honest, and Montana deserves that kind of politics.
They call it Montana Business Advocates for Sensible Elections, or Montana Base PAC. Montana Base has been filing detailed donor lists with the State Commissioner of Political Practices. Commissioner John Modell says it's actually what all PACs should be doing.
They are following the law where others may not be.
But that transparency actually brings up an interesting issue. Remember, PACs are supposed to be third-party groups, totally unaffiliated with a candidate's campaign. That's how American Tradition Partnership got in trouble, for working with candidates. So if you look at the list of donors to the Montana Base PAC, the PAC which will be fighting to elect moderate Republican candidates, the first person on that list, Senator Bruce Tutvet, donating $5,000. Senators Ed Buttrey, Taylor Brown, Lou Jones, Representatives Rob Cook, Dwayne Ankeny, Steve Gibson, it goes on. The list is packed with moderate GOP lawmakers, some of whom are running for re-election in this primary.
I can't be there. I can't be on the committee. I shouldn't have any prior knowledge of what they're doing or what they're mailing.
Senator Tutvet does not have to run this time around, so he's not speaking directly for himself there. But he says keeping the candidates' campaigns completely separate from the PAC's activity will be a tough balance.
It's going to take a little evolution here to get this right, because you want clean elections, but you want them to be able to function. You want people to be able to give advice. You want groups that do have a political reason to be.
As for the tone of this light money PAC's advertising, Tutvet says a lot of it will be on the attack.
Negative campaigning is legal, and negative campaigning works.
He believes Montana Base should be able to accomplish its goals just by showing the voting records of conservatives. What a coincidence. That's what Senator Wittig with the conservatives says they want to do.
Looking at people's record instead of, you know, trying to throw personal slights at one another and give the voters what they deserve.
One way or another, both sides will have money to spread that message. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting at the Capitol.
In December, we spoke with Olympian Heather McPhee of Bozeman about her hopes for the Sochi Olympics. McPhee is the reigning national freestyle mogul ski champion, and Sochi was her second Olympics. She placed 18th in Vancouver in 2010. In Sochi, McPhee placed 13th. Although the 29-year-old didn't make it onto the medals podium, she tells news director Sally Mock she had an experience she'll always cherish. McPhee says she was impressed with this host country's Olympic facilities.
Honestly, I was definitely impressed with what I saw. I mean, last year there was nothing there in the village. It had barely been started. And so what they were able to achieve in the last year was incredible. I was definitely comfortable. And it was so convenient to stay in the mountain village and get to our venues. They made it really easy for us to get to where we were competing. So I was thrilled.
And you'd been there before to, I guess, compete, but not in the Olympics, obviously.
Correct, yes. I had competed there in a test event the year before, pretty much exactly a year before. We hadn't stayed in the mountain village. We had stayed at some hotels at the base of the gondola in Rosa Couture. So I was familiar with the area, but had not stayed where I stayed during the Olympics.
Your event actually began before the opening ceremony, right?
It did, yeah. Our qualification day was the day before opening ceremonies, and then our finals was the day after.
So that must have been a little bit odd.
Yeah, well, we've never done a competition like that before. We don't do a qualification day and then a finals day. So that was interesting in itself. And then also we've never competed that format before of the finals rounds where they cut to 12 and then 6 and then another round. So it was more skiing if you made it all the way through than you've ever done before.
Did you participate in the opening ceremony? I think you did.
I did, and it was incredible.
Tell me what it was like to march into that fabulous stadium with all those other fabulous athletes from all over the world. Must it be just almost impossible to put into words?
Yeah, it's an incredibly powerful experience. I feel like it's when you really, truly feel that you're an Olympian, and all that work that you've done for so long is really kind of paying off, and it is such an honor to walk in representing your country and even just everybody, you know, in the same outfit. And I was actually at the last minute, my brother and sister got tickets to opening ceremonies. And so I was texting back and forth with my brother right before I was walking through the tunnel. And it was very emotional for me to know that some of my family was there. My parents had been able to be there in Vancouver and watch me walk in. And so to just know that there was family there, and I was just so proud of what I had accomplished. And I also got to walk hand in hand, got to walk in with one of my best friends, who's our team manager, who I also got to walk with in Vancouver. So pretty powerful experience.
I think I'd be doing selfies left and right.
You know, I actually ended up putting my phone away, which is, I guess, a little bit crazy. I know in this.
Oh, good for you. Good for you.
Everybody's got to have it out. But I wanted to really feel it and experience it. I took photos in the tunnel, and I definitely took some photos once I was sitting down, but I really just wanted to walk and be there.
I don't know if you can describe this, but tell me what the moment's like when you're at the top of the hill, it's your first run, and you're at the Sochi Olympics, and you're getting ready to do what you do best. I mean, what goes through your head? Do you just stay so focused on the course, or what?
Well, you know, mine actually was sort of interesting. I ended up running second out of the gate on that qualification day. And I had warned some of my teammates who hadn't competed before. I said, you know, just so you know, things run really slowly at the Olympics in comparison to another event, because there's just a lot more media and everything just seems to take more time. And there was a mix-up before I ran, and they ran me really early, and actually barely anybody caught my run. Even my family missed until, you know, middle of the middle section. My coaches didn't get it on video. It was sort of a confusing situation. So I actually felt kind of rushed. I wasn't quite prepared. It wasn't what I was expecting. But I think for me, standing there, especially qualifications, I still get a tiny bit nervous. But once I was standing there for my final run, I was so excited. I competed my back full and my D-spin, and I felt like I had nothing to lose, and I was just going to go for it. So that was really exciting for me.
And, of course, you came in 13th, Heather, out of the medals, but still you have to feel like this was just such an honor to be there. And only a very few of the many, many, many athletes who go actually end up on the podium.
Yeah, it was sort of bittersweet for me. When I came down from my finals run, where I ended up 13th, I thought for sure I was going to move on. I was so proud of what I did. I had a great run for me, and I competed both of my big tricks, the backflip and the D-spin, which has never been done by a woman at that level before, and I was just thrilled. So I was very proud of what I did, but really disappointed with the result, which was hard for me to accept. But I've always been in a judge sport. Sometimes things go your way, sometimes they don't. And I kind of switched fairly quickly into super fan mode and really enjoyed cheering everyone else on. It was interesting. This Olympics, more than ever, I knew so many competitors across a lot of different sports. And it was even more real to me than ever before that maybe three people are really happy with how it went that day. And there's a lot of people who are really disappointed, and so it's this amazing roller coaster of emotions. And I think pretty much everybody who gets to compete at the Olympics realizes that it is an incredible honor to be there, and that you're already one of the few who gets to try, who gets to compete for a medal. And it can feel really disappointing not to, but at the same time, those opportunities and those memories that you're going to have for the rest of your life way outshadow the results.
Absolutely. And how much interaction did you have with Russian people and some of the Russian athletes as well?
So in terms of the Russian people in general, there were so many volunteers around, and they were so friendly and welcoming. Way, way more of them spoke English than I was expecting, and I was very grateful for that. And they just bent over backwards to try to make you comfortable, to make sure you were getting to the right place. It was very incredible. And then Russian athletes, I know some of the mobile skiers quite well, and we had a lot of fun, and watching them compete in their own country was very fun for me, and I got to meet some of their parents, which was great. I just love seeing different cultures. So that was really fun. In terms of other sports, I didn't get to meet a whole lot of other Russian athletes. I did get to spend a lot of time and get to know lots of the Team USA athletes from other disciplines, which was really fun.
The standards of the Olympics certainly represent the world coming together in a peaceful way to celebrate the talent of all these athletes. And in the wake of Sochi, to have what's going on in Ukraine, it's so painful to make that transition and see the tragic unfolding of events there in the wake of what was such a good feeling about Sochi.
Very sad to me. I think that part of what I love about the Olympics, just like you said, is that it's the world coming together for something positive. And it seems like, as a whole, the world kind of puts everything else on hold, any sort of disagreements, anything else, and just celebrates human potential and comes together. And I love that. And I just sit there and go, why can't we do this all the time? And I know that's such a naive thing, but it's very sad, a discouraging feeling. To feel like it's only so temporary. But I do think overall it was amazing for me to be there and see that pretty much anyone from Russia that I came across was wonderful and really friendly. And I think that to judge a country by certain figures is too bad, because there's a lot of very, very wonderful people there, and I was grateful to get to know them.
Heather, we're all so proud of you from Montana and proud of your representation of our state. Congratulations again for having been an Olympian, and we hope you have a great, great future no matter what you choose to do now.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Well, I've been speaking with Heather McPhee, a Bozeman skier who competed in the freestyle moguls at the Sochi Olympics. And Heather, so fun to talk to you both before and after the Olympics. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there's a winter weather advisory in effect from 8 p.m. tonight to 11 a.m. tomorrow for the Kootenai-Cabinet region, the West Glacier region, and the Flathead and Mission Valleys. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and light freezing rain with some patchy freezing fog. Expect lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow, rain is likely with some patchy freezing fog. Highs should be in the upper 30s to mid-40s. In central Montana, there's a winter storm watch in effect from tomorrow morning through Friday afternoon for the Rocky Mountain Front. Tonight should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow in lows 15 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow, there's a chance of snow with highs 35 to 45 degrees. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow and lows in the 20s. Tomorrow, there's a chance of snow through the day with a slight chance of rain with highs in the 40s. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Hay Patrick.
Nonprofit board members, listen up. Your nonprofit organization has asked me to talk to you. Yes, you. I mean, I assume your nonprofit wants me to talk to you. Otherwise, why would the CEOs of so many nonprofit organizations, from A to Z, from arts organizations to zoos, talk to me about you? They must want me to talk to you. Nonprofit board service is a wonderful way to champion a cause you believe in, to strengthen Montana's vibrant nonprofit sector, to build your leadership skills, even to broaden your network of friends and colleagues. It's important that we get board service right. Here's what your nonprofit CEO wants me to tell you. Our conversations generally go something like this. How can I get my board to fill in the blank? Raise money, come to meetings, respond to my calls and emails, recruit other board members, do what they say they'll do. And then there are the things your nonprofit wants you to stop doing. This includes, again, fill in the blank, micromanaging, focusing on the trivial, not the important, constantly telling me to cut expenses, ignoring my advice. In our short time together, let's tackle some of these issues. Number one, fundraising. It's your job. Yes, staff plays a critical role in this, but listen up. Fundraising is the board's job. But I volunteer my time, I hear you cry. Yes, and your nonprofit wants me to tell you they appreciate that. But your time won't pay the light bill or the rent or the staff. Now, relax. There's a role every board member can play in fundraising, regardless of whether you're comfortable asking someone for money. Asking people for money is the best way, but trust me, your nonprofit CEO has other ideas that even the most fundraising-averse board member can put into action. And remember, fundraising is your job. Don't ever join a nonprofit board thinking that it isn't. There's a reason why a mantra of good nonprofit boards is give, get, or get off. Yes, you need to make sure expenses are kept in check, but your nonprofit also needs you to be a lot more active in fundraising than you have been. Your nonprofit can't cut its way to prosperity. Next, micromanaging. Stop it. You have a CEO whose job it is to manage the organization. Your job is to govern, to focus on the big picture and serious issues, including the long-term sustainability of your nonprofit. You have one employee, your CEO, who is in charge of everyone else. And as long as you are evaluating your CEO annually, and he or she is meeting or exceeding expectations and achieving mutually agreed upon goals, you ought to be listening to your CEO. That's why you have one. And if your CEO is performing well, you ought to be treating him or her like a valued partner in a higher calling, not like a subordinate to be bossed around. Answer his calls or emails promptly. Listen to her advice. Do what you say you'll do. Don't make your CEO have to remind you repeatedly. Good nonprofit boards are noses in and fingers out. So, other than for the smallest, youngest, most grassroots nonprofits, if you're hanging around your nonprofit regularly, other than to fill a volunteer shift, or if you're going over your CEO's head to the staff, or sending out board agendas and taking board minutes, stop it. Use that time to be an informed ambassador and champion of your nonprofit, to thoughtfully help plan its future, including at board meetings, to recruit new board members to the cause. And you can always use that time to fundraise. Here's something I've noticed in 3 decades of nonprofit board service. Sometimes business people put up with things in their nonprofit life that they would never stand for in their for-profit life. Your nonprofit has no clear strategic direction. It's hemorrhaging money, its reputation in your community is questionable, the CEO is AWOL or underperforming, meetings drag on unproductively, fix it. Why would you have one standard of performance for your business and another for your nonprofit? Yes, your nonprofit has a different bottom line than, say, your bank or your title company, but it must be run in a business-like way. Don't excuse mediocrity or underperformance by telling yourself, oh, it's a nonprofit, I have to measure it differently. That flawed thinking weakens not just your nonprofit, but the entire sector. Don't get me wrong. Your nonprofit deeply values your board service. Your CEO might be a little wary of being as candid with you as I am, but you can change that. Implement a board evaluation process that speaks to individual performance and to the performance of the full board. Ask your CEO how you can better fill your role as a board member and encourage a candid response. Nonprofits throughout Montana, including yours, do a heroic job every day, changing and saving and enriching lives. They can't do it without you. Thank you for all you do as a board member, and thanks for your willingness to raise your game. For more tips about good board service or for board evaluation samples, email info@missoulaunitedway.org. I'm Susan Hay Patrick. Your nonprofit and I thank you for listening.
Susan Hay Patrick is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpi.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thank you for listening, and please join me tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.